Mr. Cutlets, Mr. Cutlets, when you swing around that pork chop, I get a whiff of heaven every time you pass my doorstop. With the chicken and the brisket and the marrow and the giblets, Mr. Cutlets, spend some time with me. I know it's crazy, but it's true. It's not worth eating if it lacks the greasy. Cutlets, Mr. Cutlets, when you burst into the kitchen, you grab a fist of meatballs and a bone fruition. With the bacon and the lamb chops and the scrapple and the ham hock, Mr. Cutlets, spend some time with me. Spend some time. Spend some time with me.
And I just love that song. Steffi, I just love that song.
I think it's a really good song.
I'm Mr. Cutlets, Josh Ozersky, City Searcher's National Restaurant Editor, and I'm here with Ace newspaper reporter Stephanie Cohen.
Hello.
Stephanie, you know that our show here today is sponsored at least partially by the Hearst Ranch in California, where Citizen Kane lives, and that is a place that has animals, grass-fed animals, that are frequently dressed out and made into steaks and hamburgers.
Would Citizen Kane have approved?
Well, the beasts of the air, the fish of the sea, the biggest zoo since Noah. Remember, that's how they said? We have a special guest here today also. We've got Jerry Rosengarten. Jerry is a good friend of mine and a key member of Team Cutlets. He is the owner of one of my favorite hamburger restaurants. And also, as we'll see, a significant cultural force in the history of New York City and the country.
And the leisure suit.
Oh,
and,
that's
yes. Now, let's not give away our But
it's a tease.
I know.
Now, before we get into talking about...
Keep the listeners on the edge of their seat.
Right. Like, they're even, you know, conscious at this point.
Even listening.
Yeah, the term listeners is loosely is a loose usage. Steffi.
Yeah.
Obviously, stand bills. There's a lot going on with hamburgers today. The Rachel Ray Burger Bash, of which I was a judge. These are all topics that I want to essay in a subsequent session, or segment, as we say in the radio business. But I think we should probably talk a little bit about the experience we had the other night when accompanied me and Denise to the Breslin.
I think that place is... Now, I'm concerned because I like it so much.
Why? Why is that a cause for concern?
Because of the douchebag factor.
So you consider it a possible douche donation?
No. Every place that's cool gets run over, though.
Well, it's true.
Doesn't it? How does it not get
I'll
run over by
apps? I'll tell you.
Are you allowed to curse on the internet?
I don't see why not. I mean, as long as it's, you know, I think the...
Four letters.
The anti-Semitic screeds of which you're so fond might be over the pale. But, you know, the Mineta Tavern doesn't let everybody in. So it ends up being very exclusive.
But then I can't go.
But then you can't go, so it defeats the purpose.
Right.
And in the
maybe I am a douchebag.
See, the problem is that that hotel bar is big. The Ace Hotel is a great bar, great drinks, April's snacks and everything. So they got all those Euro types, bon vivants and so forth, with their ascots and their martini glasses.
But it's not in that neighborhood. It's in its own.
It's a douche donation.
But I think it could be saved by the fact that it's in that great neighborhood. I mean, well, first of all, let's talk about how great it is.
Okay, let's
before
I don't want to even be seen as even theoretically criticizing the Breslin.
It was great,
which I think is like a bigger Mineta, like a bigger, more accessible Mineta Tavern. In terms of like the antiquarian trend that I think is the dominant motif today, in the when you talk about the sort of the design zeitgeist, it's all the old timey look. They're all outdoing each other to have,
the oldest
of the old. Yeah. They all have the bartenders have handlebar mustaches and elbow garters and bow ties, and every light bulb has to be an Edison light bulb. I mean,
my partner started that.
Who's that?
Eric Good and Sean McPherson in the Bowery Hotel that I'm up.
Those guys are big players.
But they did the first real old. There was a gas station. I built a gas station, on top of which was now 1920s type building. So if you go into the lobby.
Wait, what does he mean a gas station?
When I first started that project, on the corner of 3rd Street and the Bowery, it was a gas station. A one-story gas station.
Yeah, I remember that.
Okay.
You remember that?
I remember the gas station there, the Bowery.
Yeah.
Because when I remember going there with you and sitting in a Victorian club chair next to Marilyn Manson.
I remember that.
That's what I think of that area. That's how
there, I've always lived in the East Village, so. Well, so have you.
So you know it.
Yeah.
And you know what the Bowery was like before that gas station was converted or built.
Bums.
Yeah, and it became...
Well, there still is that halfway house there.
People thought I was crazy.
They thought you were coming out of the halfway house?
No, not exactly. Not 100%, let's put it that
way. Still in the halfway house.
Still in the halfway house. But no, I was building... I had the Salvation Army on the right.
Right.
Had a halfway house on the left.
Right.
And behind me, I had another halfway house.
And there were gypsy encampments.
And I have a cemetery behind me.
That's right.
So between all of that, how could you build a building?
Oh, no. I find this very interesting. However,
okay.
Wait,
we're getting away from the topic at hand.
Yes.
Which I'd like to revisit it, don't get me wrong, but the greatness of the Breslin is our original topic.
And how beautiful
decor
is.
How beautiful the decor is. And I think in terms of, like, you know, a lot of these places are highly art-directed. Like, people go and they find old things. I don't think they found anything there. Like, it's generally, like, lovingly unrestored is the way that Doug Friedman described it to me. And it's, you know, it really has that old New York vibe that everyone is clutching and lusting for, but they pull it off. And then the food is wonderful, too.
That was a really fun night. And exciting food that I'd never tried.
Well,
whole pig.
You know, the food that we were there for was from Fergus Henderson, the famous English chef, whose reputation rests on his so-called nose-to-tail cookery. He likes to cook whole animals' heads and so forth. But April's going to be cooking there, and April is a great chef. I don't think anybody is a better cook than April, and I think that that room is the platform that she really deserves.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the Spotted Pig is wonderful, but it doesn't. It never. Her talents outstripped the small, modest menu there. And then the John Dory was like, she was doing very grand, serious food in a very kind of a funky, sort of constricted space.
We had a little preview of the room service menu, and
that's right. If these walls could talk, Steffi.
Oh well, and. I've found that the snacks that come with the in the mini bar, those were exceptional.
Yeah, no, I mean everything. They did the whole food and beverage program, so like the snacks in the rooms are great.
If you like salt and vinegar potato chips,
right? No, I mean, like her French fries are like, it does a disservice to them to call them French fries.
Mm-hmm.
I burned my hands in duck fat clutching at them at the Burger Bash, and. Her more ambitious menu items too. I mean, you'll see when the place opens. It's opening in a couple of weeks, but it is gonna be hot, and it can accommodate a lot of people too. I don't think it will. You know what, Stephanie? I don't think that it will be a douche donation. It's gonna be like the standard. Like
the standard,
they might congregate
though,
at the bar, but to go and sit down and drop a couple of bills on dinner, like that's not for every Monty. Off the Concord, you know.
Well, I think it's in a neighborhood that's off the beaten path, which is good too.
It's a terrible name. That's in the 30th and Broadway. It's like the Schmata district.
Yes, I understand that.
Now, this is another thing. Jerry is a veteran of the Schmata business.
Goes back a lot of years, like maybe 30?
30 years.
Yeah, that's so, a long time ago.
You probably, if we're handicapping places for a super cool hotel, boutique hotel and star restaurant, it probably wouldn't have been in 30th, 29th Street.
It would have been on the Bowery.
Would have been on the Bowery.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to go and take a little bit of session. We got yet another surprise guest star here. And this is the Mr. Cutlet Show on Heritage Network Radio.
I was born and raised down in Alabama on a farm way back up in the woods. I was so ragged that folks used to call me Patches. Papa used to tease me about it, cause deep down inside he was hurt cause he'd done all he could. My papa was a great old man. I can see him with a shovel in his hand. See, education he never had. He did wonders when the times got bad. The little money from the crops he raised barely paid the bills we made. Old life had kicked him down to the ground. When he tried to get up, life would kick him back down. One day, Papa called me to his dying bed, put his hands on my shoulder, then in tears he said, Patches, I'm depending on you, son, to pull the family through. My son, it's all left up to you. Two days later, Papa passed away, and I became a man that day. So I told Mama I was gonna quit school, but she said that was Daddy's strictest rule. So every morning before I went to school, I fed the chickens and I chopped wood too. Sometimes I felt that I couldn't go on. I wanted to leave, just run away from home. But I would remember what my daddy said, with tears in his eyes on his dying bed.
He said, Patches, I'm depending on you, son. God, I find it so moving.
Yes, it is.
You know, that's the greatness of Clarence Carter. Anyway, this is the Mr. Cutlet Show, and we're back here on the Heritage Radio Network. We have Jerry Rosengarten here, who is the owner of Stand, the inventor of the leisure suit.
I can make that in a bag.
The man who brought cool back to the Bowery. The inventor of a new accessory for the iPhone
that
is staggeringly useful.
That I'll tell you about.
And we have sitting in with us another special guest star who we'll be talking to in greater depth in the next segment, Mr. Ben Leventhal as himself.
Hello, Mr. Cutlets.
So, hello, Ben. It's nice
Thank
to
you
have
for
you
having
here.
Me.
And, of course, I'm here with my beautiful co-host, ace newspaper reporter, Stephanie Cohen.
Hi, everyone.
We are not allowed to say what newspaper you write for.
It's a mystery.
It's a mystery. Can we say that a founding father appears on its...
No.
No.
You can say, I cover the mafia.
Yes.
I love saying that.
Yes. And, really, that is one of my... I mean, in terms of personal entertainment, the sources of my table talk.
Yeah.
You covering the mafia and telling me about mafia trials is like bottomlessly enjoyable.
Am I the only person that cares in the city about the mafia?
Everybody cares.
Do people care, Jerry? Do people care?
Are they still here?
That's what everyone said. Do you care about the
mafia?
See,
the construction
care.
Business.
Care?
Construction
yeah,
business. No, they were taken out of the construction business.
No, they
business.
Weren't. Are you crazy?
They were taken out of the construction business.
This
now,
is
I don't know. That was actually during the Giuliani.
Yeah, they...
See, I built. So well, I know what the unions...
Well, somewhat they
he
were.
He knows... He,
they were somewhat, but
I think
not
you
not
could
entirely.
Probably there's
Giuliani
probably
became
some
the mafia.
Construction now.
Giuliani became the mafia.
There's probably some construction that you don't that they don't wet their beak in, but there probably is others that they like. I bet if you want to build a skyscraper or something like that, like a big project.
Well, they're in the unions.
Certainly
no,
in Brooklyn.
They went to Jersey.
They did not go to Jersey. I mean, they're in Jersey, but they're in the city.
Yeah. What do you, okay. I'm not going to argue it because I'm not.
Now, can we talk about how the mafia relates to food?
They eat.
I'm already uncomfortable with this conversation.
All right, now let's
the
forget
Fulton
about
fish market. No,
let's forget about the mafia. And let's talk about something that matters: the summit of American gastronomy, the universal signifier of food, the noble hamburger. And as you all know, I was a judge in the Rachel Ray Burger Bash recently. And as the author of what we might call the defining work on the subject.
Or only.
if you don't say so yourself.
And he does.
There is another book. Another Hamburger History came out like a day after mine. And George's book is very fine. Anyway.
So there's three.
There's a lot of books. There's a whole literature on hamburgers, as there should be, for a piece of Americana so pregnant with meaning. But Jerry is somebody that I'm interested in because he took a business that was pretty much on the ropes with Stand. Remember Jonathan Moore had Stand?
Certainly.
And Jerry took it over, and he's doing a nice job with it. And I think that it would be interesting to have somebody who's actually in the business say something about hamburgers instead of me just pontificating and orating all the time.
Can I ask a question first?
Why not?
I mean, if for some listeners, if you said he opened Stand, or if you said he invented the leisure suit, which grabs you?
Well, obviously.
More.
Obviously. Right.
So can we tell that story first?
Well, the problem is I'm not selling leisure suits now. I am selling hamburgers.
But the problem is that I think it's very interesting. What's if it, you make what? It short, you know, a quick
Jerry,
quick
I think
version.
There, I think Stephanie raises a good point.
We could be here for another week.
No, we can't.
We don't care that much.
You have a finite segment.
Yeah, we want two minutes or less on the leisure suit. 1 minute.
First of all, does everyone, Ben,
I don't know
as a young person... Do you even know what a leisure suit is?
I do, and I sit in awe.
Jesus. Let me say something very simple.
Okay.
Because I'm not necessarily proud of the image of the leisure suit.
Right.
Even though I created it.
Right. That's tough.
Everything I've ever done that I've created, and that's basically one of the things I like to do, has been knocked off and knocked off and knocked off. So eventually it became a joke. On the Johnny Carson show.
Right.
Okay? The creation of the leisure suit was real simple. Fashion for men in the 70s and before was very, very structured. Suits, ties, and so forth. The leisure suit was the first advance away from that. And the Leisure Fridays or the whatever they call the Fridays that you don't wear ties.
Leisure Fridays. Yeah. That's what they're called.
And basically what's occurred is that guys...
Or casual Fridays.
No, it is actually casual.
Corporate world calls it.
It's actually casual
Leisure Friday.
So that's what happened from the leisure suit. From my standpoint, it actually opened up much more leisure casual type clothing for men.
But the original leisure suit was an unconstructed matched jacket and pants?
That you didn't need to iron?
Actually, I don't know if you guys know double knits. Double knits, because double knits were a fabric that was made in the 70s and early 80s, which was a fabric that was made in consort. And I had a textile company making double knits, okay? It was a fabric that the leisure suit was made out of. It was a knit fabric. And what you could do is you could roll it up, take it out, and it would be pressed. So right. It was that type of thing.
Polyester.
It was polyester.
We won't say that word, but that's really what it was.
That when you say polyester, you're thinking of the kind of polyester that your grandmother wore.
Oh, no, I'm thinking of the nice polyester, the beautiful polyester.
But Jerry, wasn't there double knits that were higher quality? You told me that you had a loom with 10,000 gears
No, it wasn't a loom. It was a knit machine. And it would knit, let's say, the regular was 18 gauge, this was 32 gauge.
Right.
But you still would sweat like a pig in it.
See, she's thinking of the TJ Maxx.
No, she doesn't.
There's only one kind of polyester.
See, Jerry, will you clear this up?
She doesn't understand one part of it. When you're dealing with a double knit, it could be 90% polyester and 10% cotton knitted that way. Oh. And the inside could, in fact, absorb.
Sweat.
Absorb sweat, which is wicks it out. Would actually wick it through the knit.
See, Jerry, these are the misconceptions you've been fighting.
But we can go on for a week. I don't want to go. I really want to talk about the Stand.
That's an interesting thing though, because this is sort of two zeitgeist items. I think that in the same way that the leisure suit occupies a certain place in our common cultural consciousness, I think the hamburger does too, and I think that the place that it occupies is changing. Thanks to operators like yourself and April Bloomfield and the Shake Shack and all people like that that approached the hamburger as a sort of an artisanal object. Now, can you talk about the hamburger? Your hamburger at Stand,
mm-hmm.
it's got, the Stand burger has got little parsleys in it and onions and mm-hmm. something else. Can you talk about that a little bit?
I won't tell you what's in it, but I'll tell you right now that as far as the Stand is concerned, we've created unique burgers. So you can't get them anyplace else. In business, you want to create something that's unique. And then what happens is people knock it off, but basically, or try to knock it off, I should say. But basically, you want to create something unique that brings your customers back because they want that taste. Now, I'm not a cook, okay, but I do know what I like, and I do
now,
know
how did you? How did you end up? This is something, too, that people must be asking themselves.
I am.
How did you end up owning and directing a hamburger restaurant?
I'm the landlord of the building.
Oh, that's right.
Okay, and I ended up having to take it over.
Right.
And I...
But a lesser man would have just brought in a consultant.
I didn't know it went down that way.
Didn't go down 100% that way.
Okay.
But the reality of it is I did take it over. I kept on telling the guys what they were doing wrong, in my opinion.
Well, like what? What did you tell them?
They weren't watching it more carefully. I said that they had basic hamburgers. They didn't really have unique stuff. And they kept on saying, well, this is the concept for to go forward to more stores and all that. And I said, no, that's not the concept. The concept should be unique things. I didn't like the French fries, so I changed the French fries. I changed basically many items in the menu, which are now the signature items.
It's interesting. It's an entrepreneur's approach to a hamburger joint versus a chef's.
Right.
Differentiation.
I have no idea what I'm doing. I just know.
Well, no one will hold that against you.
No, by the way, I've never known what I'm doing.
But that, so I think this is interesting, though, because this is a thing where, like, this is how malleable the hamburger is. Has such a universal medium that, like, here's Jerry's, like, a smart Jewish guy, no culinary background, never been in the restaurant business.
But is he making any money there?
Well, let's set that aside for the moment. I mean, I don't want to put
Jerry... He doesn't have to answer, but...
But I can answer.
That's not the point.
By the way, I will not be in any business that I don't make money.
See?
I don't want to put the guy in the spot. You know, it's like someone asking me if their girlfriend's pretty or something.
You want to put me on the spot?
No, but what I'm saying is, Jerry, just by virtue of being an American, knew enough about hamburgers to offer an opinion with conviction to the guy that was running it then.
That's right. Well, but everybody gives their opinion. So they could.
Well, they don't give their opinion about chicken tikka masala.
I don't even know what that is.
Exactly. You wouldn't give your opinion about it. I mean, if some, like the opinion of, like, when Josh DeCellis had his tempura restaurant and nobody could figure out why it was no good. And I said, well, like, maybe your oil's too hot. I mean, no one has any idea. It's like why is your fried mushroom not good? Who the hell knows?
It's interesting. This is not magic. This is a matter of experimentation. Continue experimentation until you come up with something that someone, because it's every restaurant has either a chef or an owner who has a taste, and that his taste is what should guide the place. In this situation, I'm not a chef. I only know what I like, and I basically want to be different than everyone else. Now, will I stay that way? No, because as I said, they pick up whatever sells. The world will pick up.
It's capitalism.
Yeah.
So that's great. Then the hamburger then kind of assumes a universal role. Like, it's like if you imagine Adam Smith's guiding hand, the invisible hand of Adam Smith, you could imagine it lifting up a hamburger.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
I'm seeing it.
Right?
Yeah. No, it's true that everyone has an opinion about... I would not have an opinion about, you know, how to cook halibut. I don't know how to cook halibut, but I know exactly how I like my burgers.
Yeah, it's,
and I don't like them any other. I want them the way I want them. Mm-hmm.
The other meme that,
so possibly you come to Stand and taste something different.
I want to.
Now the other meme I think that was worth mentioning here is now everybody wants to have these marshmallow shakes.
That's another thing they knocked off.
That I think really is the where Stand has gotten
credit. We have the next one, so it's okay.
You already have the next one?
Of course.
What is it?
I want to know where you are when you have your inspiration. Like, what are you doing when you say, double knit leisure suit. I want to unroll it, but not iron it. I mean, what were you? Are you in the bath? What are you doing?
That's actually, as I said, a longer story. I was in a portion of the retail business. I had three jobs when I was in high school and college.
You did?
Yeah. So, you know, you learn a lot of different things in that area. But, you know, are we having to go to break?
No, yeah, well, I'm afraid so. I mean, I would find inspiration in that tale, certainly. I mean, having not had any jobs.
Well, then maybe you'll help me write a book about it.
I might be called upon to do that. I'm Josh Ozersky, a.k.a. Mr. Cutlets, and this is The Mr. Cutlets Show.
Across your back, I can see you had your fun, but darling, can't you see my signals turn from green to red? And with you, I can see a traffic jam straight up ahead. You're just right. So hard to get through to you.
You know, I think I like Patches. I have to say, I think I like Patches better. I don't think Crosstown Traffic is
the Cutlet
is
song.
The ideal.
More than I mean,
Jack, is my voice coming through clearly?
What is Patches?
Patches is a song. It was a hit for Clarence Carter in 1974, written by a man named General Johnston. It was a very mawkish, bathetic country hit.
Mm-hmm. I understood everything you just said.
Yeah. Well, let's set aside the issues of double knits and double patties for the moment and turn to our other guest, who actually is quite a personage in the New York food media, something of a macher in his own right, even though he's technically supposed to be on the sidelines, but every restaurateur cavils at the at his pen.
Cavils.
Yeah, they cavil sometimes, and they cavil they,
the girls.
He's held in dread and awe by the city's restaurant community, Ben Leventhal of Eater.
It's quite an intro. Thank you, Josh.
Now, Ben, I do think, though, that Eater has, and I say this as a former rival, I think that Eater has the field largely to itself now. You guys have really, in terms of rounding up, agglomerating everything, breaking stories, I mean, micro coverage. I mean,
I don't know if we have the field to ourselves, but we're certainly, we're certainly knee deep in it, and we certainly love being in the field. I think that, you know, we have some worthy competitors. I think it, at times that you're a worthy competitor, especially on the topic of meat and the chefs and restaurants that you follow closely when you're on the feedback. So,
well, I think that when in my own particular departments, when writing ex cathedra on the feedback, I think that there's no competition.
What does that mean?
I don't know.
Well, it means from the chair, and alludes to
the
papal authority of St. Peter.
this language barrier may be some of the problem of the feedback.
It's not a problem. I am a...
How do you know that...
What?
What?
Go on. No, what were you going to say?
Do you think that everyone... How did you get this way of speaking? How did this happen?
It's all body language.
I mean,
where did
listen,
you pick this up? As a 16-year-old?
If you want to read...
In Atlantic City?
If you want to read the regular journalistic colloquial vocabulary of 700-plus words, you can read it on
exactly.
in Us Magazine, or even Coco the Gorilla can read it to you.
That's true.
I am offering something different. You know what I mean? Like, I have my own particular thing. But when I was in the... Both in the... For most of the feedback and then all for all of my time at Grub Street, I was also trying to stay on top of all the big stories and all the big openings. And I broke more than my share of them. In fact, I think at one point I had the field to myself. But I think Eater now is the leading news gatherer and also news leader. Do you look at Eater? Stephanie?
I'm not as... yes, I look at Eater. But you know what I have read that I really enjoyed... If we can go back. I don't know when you did. When did you do that original? What was it called?
She Loves New York?
Yeah, I thought that was really cute.
Oh, thank you.
Is that how you started
She Loves
blogging?
New York is actually... is the precursor to Eater in a lot of ways. She Loves New York was a hobby that I did in 2003 and 2004, which was just a cheat sheet on New York at a particular moment in time. The hot new restaurants, the classic restaurants... and we sort of synced it up to whatever was happening in pop culture. So, you know,
but it had that cute conceit of the sending a guy out on a date.
We are the
what was
main,
that?
The main character of the site was a kid named Maddie, who was well intentioned but a little misdirected, and we helped him find places to take his dates.
Get laid.
Yeah,
that's great.
So yeah, the DNA of Eater comes from She Loves New York and. Another site called Below 14th Street, which my partner Lockhart was writing at the same time. And Below 14th Street is where sort of the Plywood Report comes from and those sorts of things. And we met when we were both doing those sites, and we were fans of each other's projects.
How
did you know each other like in prep school or anything?
No,
like that?
No, no.
That was a dig.
No, really. I mean, I'm curious as how these things work.
No, it was really, you know, the magic of the web, as they say. We just had a mutual respect for each other. Locke grew up in Maine, outside of Boston, in Massachusetts, and
Maine.
Well, he has a summer house in Maine, in Prouse Neck, and he grew up in, I believe, he grew up more accurately outside of Boston, and he's been in the city for 10 years. I grew up in the city, so yeah, we met when we were doing those projects.
And how did you decide to start?
Well, they started. They started Curbed before Eater, right?
Correct.
No, nothing. I'm just curious how you decided to do How She Loves New York, how that
She Loves New York started... I was working at VH1, and I was sitting in a cube, you know, I guess most businesses now, but that in 2001 and 2, that all of the low-level people sat in these big sort of pens at Viacom, and one of the people that sat across from me was a kid named Matt, mm-hmm. and we called him Matty, and he's from upstate New York, and he's a perfectly charming guy, and super excited about being in New York, but you know wouldn't know Balthazar from KFC, right. And you know, we just had conversation after conversation about where should he take this girl and what should he do when his mom's in town, and we had it really like the first things I wrote for She Loves New York were actually just repurposed emails that we had back and forth.
Cute,
yeah.
It has authentic feel.
I like She Loves New York a lot, and I think more people should know about it. And do you still write?
No.
You never write it anymore.
It's unfortunately been dormant since we started Eater.
Well, let me speed up to that, because while we'll have you in the next episode next week, I want to make sure that people probably want to know some basic things.
Sure.
So you and Locke founded Curbed, which was a real estate...
No, I can't take credit for Curbed. Lockhart founded Curbed in 2004.
Okay.
It's actually right around the time that we first met, and I did nothing more than sort of make stupid suggestions about what he should do with Curbed, and then that was at the same time that we were starting to get to know each other, and you know, we quickly realized that we had the same take on restaurants and food in New York, which was A, to be completely obsessed with it, and B, to be as much fixated on the physical space of a restaurant than is the food, right? So, you know, we just sort of like love sitting down and having a bottle of wine and having a roast chicken or whatever it is, and that whole experience is important as, you know, the blend of the meat, the blend of the burger for us. So that was really, Eater, we started Eater.
That was the following year in 2005.
In 2005, yeah. And in that year before, we sort of had spent some time together and had some meals together and had sort of come around to understanding we had the same philosophy on all this. And then we founded Eater in 2005, and there were only two rules at the start. And that was that there was going to be no reviews and no food porn, no pictures of food.
Both of which have been broken since then.
Well, in special cases, yes.
But it's true. Eater was always very, it always read as very brisk and very fact-based. And it was always, even when people would say, oh, well, it's gossip, this and everything, it was never gossip from any particular perspective. It was just what you guys heard. And they were really, Steffi, I mean, as a, you and I are both basically print people mm-hmm. at heart. But, I mean, those guys, I don't think... They really, like, that was their natural element. I mean, nobody needed to tell them. Like, you see, like, in blogs, like, that when, like, Slate or the Washington Post, whoever, and, like, somebody makes a mistake, and then they, like, you see there's, like, a strike through, and, like, it said, like, in the original version of this, like, the guy spelled St. Louis wrong or some shit, you know? Get the fuck out of here. You never, that's something you would have never seen on Eater, and right. I never, when I have had control, I mean, you never would see something like that on a site.
You're a print person.
I'm a print person. It takes me a long time. See, Eater has, this is an amazing thing. Eater has over 20 posts a day. I mean, at the best, when I was really working hard trying to get the feedback up and running, I could never do more than 7.
But how many people work there?
Well, we have a lead editor, and she's assisted by a team of interns and contributors. But the key difference, Josh, is, you know, what Eater does is we get it out there.
Right.
It's really a very, it's supposed to be very brass tacks with few exceptions, and most of those exceptions involve lots of pictures.
Right.
So it's still very easy to digest. And I think, you know, that's the reason why Eater can do 20 posts a day versus the feedback where you struggle to do 7. It's in a lot of ways, it's a different format.
Well, you know, I'm addicted to my polished periods and studied sentences, as Johnson said. You know what? And I'm enjoying this conversation so much that I'm going to invite Jerry Rosengarten and Ben Leventhal to come back for next week's show, which we're about to record. And again, I'd like to thank the Heritage Radio Network. I'm here at Roberta's, my favorite restaurant in Brooklyn. Courtesy of the Heritage Radio Network and the Hearst Ranch, I'm Josh Ozersky, City Search Editor, and this is the Mr. Cutlet Show.
Mr. Cutlets, when you swing around that pork chop, I get a whiff of heaven every time you pass my doorstop with the chicken and the brisket and the marrow and the giblets. Mr. Cutlets.